This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin and Sharmila Ganesan. Tonight, how can we solve the problem of the first and last mile in public transportation? And where does micromobility come into the picture?
So we'll very shortly be joined by two experts who are here to answer all our questions and yours. We'll be looking at issues of safety, infrastructure, cost, among other things.
So send us your thoughts, your questions. What would solve the last mile problem in Malaysia? And are you curious? Do you have any thoughts or questions you want to share when it comes to micromobility? You can call us 7733 2900, send us a voice note or a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is just about 6:08. So to start us off, before we talk about public transportation, I think we need to talk about the opposite, which is the over-reliance that Malaysians have on cars or personal vehicles. Because as of 2019, the Transport Ministry has registered some 31.2 million vehicles. And if we look at what that ends up meaning, according to the World Bank in 2015, working class Malaysians are estimated to spend about 1 million hours annually stuck in traffic congestion per day. That translates to a total of 10 to 2 billion ringgit every year. This number is calculated based on fuel wastage, carbon emissions, opportunity cost in time wasted, and all of which is really just the backing for the ongoing conversation we've been having anyway about public transport, because there isn't really a debate about whether public transport is necessary or something that we should all be moving towards. I think the question is, why isn't it something that is more easily accessible or more efficient or more any other positive word you want to insert here in our country?
Because the question isn't even whether we have sufficient public transportation modes. And I want to very carefully say that, because obviously, even in the last 10 years, we've seen our rail network and our rail network in particular grow by leaps and bounds. And, you know, that's great. We have the MRTs, we have the LRTs. But where this often comes to a sticking point is, how do I get from my home to the LRT or the MRT? And if the answer is that I drive there, kind of defeats the purpose, right? And so that brings us to the perennial problem when it comes to using public transportation, particularly in places like the Klang Valley, the last and first mile connection.
Or do I walk a kilometre in the hot sun?
In the hot sun, on bad sidewalks, or the rain.
Yes, and with the issue of safety. So now there's another option that has kind of entered the market, and that is micromobility vehicles. So I just think we've been saying micromobility a lot, but it's not necessarily something that is the first word that comes to mind if you were, for example, thinking about e-bikes or e-scooters, even though that's what we mean. And that, I think, if you're driving around, sadly, or walking around, would have been something that you would see, right? It's something that either the scooters are by the side of the road or people are zipping by anyway. So increasingly, it is an option.
So starting from July this year, Beam Mobility basically launched a Drive Something New Today campaign. And Beam's mission has been to make cities flow better through the usage of e-scooters, which aims to at least fill this gap, right? The last mile, first mile connectivity by connecting people to transit points, popular destinations, hotspots. And by May this year, almost 50% of the 1,800 Beam riders who were surveyed say that this access to e-scooters for the first or last mile of a journey has made them more likely to consider using public transport. But this comes on the wake also of a interesting push and pull that's happening between the idea of using micromobility vehicles and where it might fall within larger plans that, let's say, the Transport Ministry has. Because in April this year, our Transport Minister, Datuk Sri Dr. Wee Kah Siong, announced a ban on certain types of micromobility vehicles on the roads because of it being a danger, concerns around safety. There was also talk of regulation. There was talk of introducing a bylaw to govern the use of micromobility vehicles. So it's an interesting time, I think, because it's a time when I think this is something that's gaining popularity very quickly, but it's also something that's new that many people have hesitations about, concerns about, but also offers, I would cautiously say, some solutions.
So we want to hear from you. What do you think would solve the first and last mile problem in our country when it comes to public transportation? And do you have questions that you'd like to ask when it comes to the issue of micromobility? You can call 7733-2900, send us a voice note or a WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we're going to be joined by Faris Faisal, transport consultant at Arup, a global sustainable development consultancy, as well as Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micromobility Research Partnership. So keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Break from mediocrity, BFM 89.9.
It is coming up to 6:14 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We're talking today about public transportation and trying to address the perennial first and last mile problem in our country. So we'd like to hear from you. What do you think would solve that issue? And also, if you have questions on micromobility, send them our way as well, because we're talking today about how that fits into the picture. You can call 7733-2900, send us a voice note or a WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now, we have Faris Faisal, a transport consultant from Arup, a global sustainable development consultancy, as well as Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micromobility Research Partnership. Faris, Ferdinand, thank you both so much for joining us.
Selamat petang.
Hello. Selamat petang.
Hello to you both again. So, all right, we've been kind of talking about this, but I think it'll be best to hear about it from both of you. Let's start with the first and last mile problem. What exactly does it mean and how significant is this issue? Faris, maybe you can start us off.
So before we even continue down this conversation, I think it's important for everyone to understand that typically how a public transport network would look like is you would have a main trunk line, sort of like the trunk of your tree. This is where most of the people would be transferred from one destination to another. Now, as you get to different parts of the cities and you're getting to different parts of towns, you're trying to get into smaller transportation modes. So for your trunk line in Kuala Lumpur, it's basically our metro line and the MRT, your KTMs, your LRT. But the smaller transportation modes, these are usually served by buses, or in some cities, it's tram lines. So then from that, those points, you're trying to get to smaller neighborhoods. You're trying to get to your schools. You're trying to get to the central business districts. You're trying to get to your retail areas. And once you reach that, from that bus station or tram station to get to your door, that's your first mile, last mile journey. It's literally from your doorstep to a transportation station, and then from that final transportation station to your final place of interest. And its significance to the bigger transportation network is very important, because all of these are complementary services. If you have a poor transportation mode for your first mile, last mile journey, people don't even get into your main transportation network. So then even if you have an amazing trunk line, people just don't use it at the end of the day.
So we often hear of things like park and rides, or of people living and working far away from bus stops. What can you tell us about the way Malaysians commute on a daily basis?
So typically within Klang Valley, you don't do the first mile, last mile journey via the more theoretical way, which is you're trying to do active mobility or riding micromobility devices and then get to a bus station, which then transfers you to the bigger train network. What typically happens is, or like what you just said, Sharmila, it's you're trying to get from your doorstep via a private vehicle, whether be it your own private vehicle or you do e-hailing, all the way to a train station that has a park and ride service there. And then hopefully then you go through your whole public transport journey, and then at the final station, get from your final transportation station all the way to your office or your school via another e-hailing service, or hopefully it's close enough that you can walk. So that's how people usually commute here.
Can I ask you both whether you take public transport in our country? So, Ferdinand, I understand that you lived here for a long time. You have moved. But let's start with you. I mean, when you lived in Malaysia, were you taking public transport?
Yes, indeed. I used to take a lot of the rail in Kuala Lumpur. And in the very early days, I used to take the bus all the way from Taiping to Kuala Lumpur as well and back. So I'm quite, I know the public transport system personally since about 35 years. And I would add to what Faris just said is that what I found from experience is that often the bits of public transport are a bit remote from each other. So a person might be able to take one line, get to the end of that, and then have to walk a reasonable distance. And as you said in the introduction, it's often hot or it rains very hard. And I do remember with some amusement running around in my suit and my suitcase, basically to dodge the raindrops. And that was not very comfortable. And that is where solutions also need to be found, because once that starts to happen, this disjointedness to some extent, that causes people also to reflect on whether they should be using public transport.
Faris, what about you?
I do on a daily basis, well, almost on a daily basis. So I go from my house all the way to Putrajaya Central, and then I'll take the ERL to KL Central, and then I'll walk over to Museum Negara, where I'll take the MRT to my final stop, which is in Bandar Utama, and then it's just a walk to the office. But I would like to just build upon what Ferdinand just said. One of the things that it's interesting to know is trains at almost all homes within Klang Valley, they're about 1 to 3 kilometers away from a train station, any MRT, LRTs, or KTM. And that is what's perceived as your typical first mile, last mile journey within Klang Valley. So it's a little bit too far to just walk, but it's also a little bit inefficient for you to drive. So that's why there's this perception where if you're going to make that 3 kilometer journey by a car, you might as well make it all the way to your final destination. Especially with the pandemic, people might feel a little bit more comfortable in their own cars as well.
And before we continue talking about vehicles, because essentially micromobility, we're still going to be talking about vehicles, right? I wanted to put it to both of you. What is a reasonable amount of walking to expect in Malaysia? Because we've been talking about walking. We've also talked about how difficult it is. And I think in order to talk about first, last mile, we need to establish how much of that first and last mile should we be expecting to walk anyway?
This is called a walk shed, isn't it, Faris? And I think it also depends on the weather and the climate and the conditions and so on. But I believe it is about 500 meters or so, Faris, that people feel comfortable to walk.
Yeah, zero with the best trains right next door. But zero all the way to 800 meters is reasonable. Most, for example, in Singapore, the most recent re-evaluation of their land transport master plan for 2040, I think put it to, they want everyone to be within 10 minutes from a public transport station. So that's another way of viewing it. Rather than viewing it as a distance, you just think about it as a time. 10 minutes walking is not too bad.
So we've established what the challenge is, i.e. the first and the last mile connectivity. What is it specifically that has caused this to be such a big problem in Malaysia? Ferdinand, if you wanted to kick things off.
Yes, I think it comes back to that advertisement or that announcement on the short news excerpt before, that retail sales have ballooned because so many cars are being sold. And that is really one of the biggest issues, is that car ownership in Malaysia is very high per capita, and that transport emissions are also high and still growing. I think it was about 14 million tons per year or so. And a lot of that is being caused by private car transport. Of course, you have the trucks and you have other things, but it's predominantly the private car. Because as far as says, you know, if you're going to the public transport station anyway, you might as well stay in the comfort of your car and go the whole way. And the other problem is on those short rides and in congested driving, the emissions are significantly higher. It's very inefficient to run the car in that way.
So let's then talk about how other countries have addressed this. Are there interesting observations that can be shared from how other people have handled it?
Well, in some cases, like if you look, because the MRP looks globally at different case studies, and you know, we've looked at London, we've looked at Scandinavia, at Europe, the way how cities are built in Australia, New Zealand, and the USA. There's quite a diversity of approaches, and often this has happened because of the car-centric nature when those cities were built. So in Europe, for example, the cities, and I talked about it with Paris before about Amsterdam, they tended to be clustered around, you know, convenience, almost like a 20-minute sort of walk shed, because they didn't have cars and they had horses and they walked. Whereas a lot of the cities in the US, Australia, New Zealand, for example, have grown at a time when the car was just starting to be introduced, allowing for a much wider and less denser build-up. And so that is how it's been approached. And those countries are also having more problems because they've followed the car-centric model, which basically said, okay, it doesn't matter where you live, you can always drive a car, you will get there. And so that is comparatively different with Europe, and you'll see, for instance, dynamics that there's a higher percentage of public transport usage. In Holland, for example, there are a lot more bikes. Faris has some good examples of that as well, how that came to be. And so the cities have all sort of grown around the history and the legacy and tried to address things. And I don't want to jump into micromobility yet, but it's one of the things, having grown up in Holland, where I'm very used to biking. We used to bike everywhere. I used to bike 10 kilometers to school and back. It was a very normal thing. Every school child did it. So personal mobility, active mobility, and micromobility are great options to somehow bridge or to fill the gaps and make the connectivity happen.
Faris, if you could start this off, do you think it is possible for us to adapt these measures into our existing transportation system?
I think an interesting story to just support this would be what Ferdinand just briefly mentioned, which is the story of how Amsterdam came to be. So back in the 50s, post-World War, a lot of people started doing quite well because of the Industrial Revolution. They started earning a lot more, so they started buying a lot more cars. So in the 70s, Amsterdam, what we think of it right now as cycling haven for commuters, was not the case back then. And what happened was a few things, but all these things happened organically, bear in mind. So number one, there was a car-free Sunday, and the reason for it was just because there was an oil embargo, so people were trying to figure out how to cut the amount of oil they were using. So that's number one. Because there was an increase in cars on the road, and before that, nobody really used cars, so kids were still playing on the streets, it led to a lot of accidents between motor vehicles and children. So this led to a lot of mothers protesting. A lot of mothers protesting and a lot of social advocacy groups protesting as well. So then policymakers started understanding that this cannot continue, riots cannot continue. So they decided to sit down, have a proper conversation about how do we move forward and what common ground can they come to. And that led to a final trial, which was a dedicated bike lane. So this is a physical infrastructure that they resulted into what we think of Amsterdam when we think of today. It's everyone's just cycling everywhere. And there's a lot of parallels between Malaysia and that story. It's because we do have an increase in wanting to reduce private transport consumption. We don't have an oil embargo, but it's because people have turned cycling into a hobby. People realize the jam's not something they want to see every day. So that's number one. We don't have riots going on or protest groups, but we have a lot of social advocacy championing the idea of public transportation, active mobility, micromobility being a part of that whole ecosystem. And then we have political will because there's a lot of capital injection into infrastructure projects within Malaysia. Policymakers through different governments have understood that this is a problem and there needs to be a solution. So that political will is something we truly have to appreciate. But moving forward, it's a matter of identifying truly what is the best solution for this, as well as the timeline to roll out these programs, because infrastructure projects don't happen overnight. You don't have an MRT overnight. You have it over the course of maybe 15 years from idea fruition all the way to operations. So throughout that whole cycle, you have to be honest and have to reevaluate your transport master plans. You have to reevaluate your whole plans and how you're going to follow through. So from those parallels, I really think that it is possible. It's just a little bit of tweaking, and it's good because we can learn from history. You don't have to hope these things organically happen, all these cogs coming into play, but rather we can engineer it to happen.
On the line with us today is Faris Faisal, transport consultant at Arup, and Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micromobility Research Partnership. And together we are talking about the first and last mile problem in Malaysia, as well as where micromobility comes into the picture, which is what we're going to be starting off with after the news. Send us your thoughts. What would solve this issue? Do you think micromobility is the way? And what questions do you have on that? You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or a WhatsApp 018 789 8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bigotry Free Malaysia, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:38 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila, and we are continuing our conversation now on public transportation in the country, particularly this issue of the first and last mile, because we just don't live near enough to the stations. That's the long and short of it. And specifically on this side of things, looking at how micromobility enters the picture. So we'd like to hear from you. What do you think would solve the last mile problem in our country, and the first mile for that matter? And what questions do you have when it comes to micromobility? Do you think that it might be the solution here? You can call 7733 2900, send us a voice note or a WhatsApp 018 789 8899, and tweet us at BFM Radio. We're continuing our conversation now with Faris Faisal, transport consultant from Arup, as well as Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micromobility Research Partnership. And that, I think, is a good start, because we do have questions coming in and we'll get to them right after this. So, Ferdinand, I want to put this to you. What makes micromobility an option to address our longstanding first and last mile issues?
Well, mostly it's because of what Farah said in the beginning, is that people tend to take cars for shorter drives, 5-6 kilometers or so. And this is actually a predominant percentage in most countries, so over 50%, it depends on where you are. Here in New Zealand, up to 70-75% of trips are actually up to 5 kilometers. And that's a perfect sort of distance for micromobility for e-scooters. That's where they do best. So the average distance for an e-scooter can be 2 to 5 kilometers, and you can have another micromobility vehicle for a bit longer. Why this is so cool is that at those first stages of driving, the engine is still at a cold start, and so the emissions are significantly higher, by sometimes a factor of 1.4 to 2 times as high. So if you could replace that, so every time when you turn on your engine, it has to get warmed up sufficiently to run efficiently. And so this is actually the best trip to replace with something like a micromobility vehicle.
So we do have a number of messages and voice notes from listeners. Let's start with this one from Alex.
Hey BFM, Alex here. So I'm wondering if micro-mobility efforts would actually even work in Malaysia. Because even if we did have e-scooters around to solve the first and last mile problem, are our roads and sidewalks actually suited for this? Or will that then also discourage the use of these e-scooters and etc.? So maybe e-scooters are viable in certain cities, but before we adopt it as a whole, maybe we should ensure that we actually have an acceptable level of road systems and sidewalks in place. To me, at least, it feels like the deterrent is the fact that we lack a basic level of infrastructure, not that it is not advanced enough.
Ferdinand, Faris, any of you care to address that?
Okay, so that's actually a very, very valid concern. It is true, but it, one thing to keep reminding ourselves is what I said earlier, which was infrastructure projects do not come to completion very quickly. So with that said, it's very nice if in our daily lives we're able to structure things to happen A, B, C, D, but what most of the times you need things to happen in parallel. So transportation, like the choice of modes of transportation, is a social engineering topic. It's not just hard physical engineering. So we really need to mold behaviors. And for someone to truly believe that using first mile, last mile journeys with active mobility or micro mobility devices and then going to a public transport network and doing the whole commuting journey is a viable way of commuting, I would even argue it takes a decade for that sort of belief to happen within someone. It's a kid that's doing it right now at 12 years old. And then when they turn 22, they turn 25, working adult in the city, that's when they realize this is possible. So for that to happen, yes, it's true, like what Alex said, there needs to be basic infrastructure right now. And the point is to have all parties come together. So policymakers, transport operators, both public transport and private transport operators, like Beam for micromobility, and then you want private consultants like AROP, municipality councils, and even end users to be able to come together to figure out what are the steps to for you to reach your final destination, your final end game of what a transportation should look like. And you need all these stakeholders to come into play, because everyone tends to have their own blind spots when reviewing a certain problem. So we're hoping to be able to cover that, as well as any new innovative or even insightful understanding to the problem based off each other's experiences and their own knowledge base. So that's just to address what Alex mentioned just now.
Yeah, that's why the Micromobility Research Partnership pulls together academics and thinkers and researchers from all over the world. They bring together different aspects and different experiences and so on to look at how that works. And I think Faris is correct. And also the thing is, as Alex asked about the infrastructure for micromobility is much easier to tackle than, let's say, an extra highway or an extra artery or an extra lane. And it does happen in parallel, because when policymakers and engineers have to decide on what to put where, they also have to see some of the behaviors and drivers and demand for that. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg. The other thing I would say is that there are certain parts of Malaysia, for example, Shah Alam, which is very well set up for micromobility. And I would not advocate micromobility on a highway, for example, where it's not suitable, where things have not been set up. But normally users will feel that or sense that themselves. But as the momentum grows, there will be more and more interest to actually dedicate space where it is possible, and where it's safe, and where it increases the uptake of micromobility. And I think we're all on this journey globally, basically, since it was launched in 2017, because you know, for cities were just not ready for it anywhere, really. And Malaysia is really the first, the leader in Southeast Asia to actually trial with this and to make this happen.
So that is the question of infrastructure. We do also have another voice note raising a separate point, but one that's coming through in other messages too. Here is Divya.
I think micro-mobility vehicles like scooters would be really helpful if we want to sort of solve the last mile issue here. Really, the main problem is that we don't have the infrastructure in place. So I guess if we were to have the micro-mobility vehicles, I guess when do we start, you know, making sure we have the right pavements, the right sort of infrastructure to use the scooters? Because as you know, we can't use it on the road. So there'd have to be some special pathway where we could use the vehicles. And I guess the other thing is the cost of the vehicles. Like, how would that system work? Is it something where the government would sort of have vehicles where you could use it and then drop it off wherever, like, you know, what we have kind of right now? Would we have to buy our own micro-mobility vehicles? So I guess it's also a question of affordability when it comes to them.
So thank you so much, Divya, for sending that. Again, if you'd like to send through a voice note or a WhatsApp, it's 018-789-8899-7733-2900 is the number to call. So to pick up on what Divya was talking about, we just addressed infrastructure. But that other question of cost, of whether we would be doing ride sharing of micro-mobility vehicles, whether we're expected to get our own, where are we on that? What would the future look like in this area?
I think I'll ask that one, answer that one first, and then we'll see where we go. It really is actually one of the cheaper transport infrastructure investments if you look at it at a cost for emission reductions. A lot of these large infrastructure projects for transportation, they can cost millions or billions. They take up to 15 years. So the good thing about micromobility, there is an aspect of shared micromobility, and shared micromobility is actually managed by experienced operators that are now increasingly experienced because it's been a business that's been going for about 4 years now. And the technology on these vehicles has improved immensely to improve the safety of the rider and safety of pedestrian and other road users. And to be able to actually make sure that the vehicle is used in the correct way, in the correct spaces, where you can geofence, for example. And the cost to the government and to the public is actually limited to these fixes to infrastructure and to add some extra space for lanes. So I did an analysis on one of the proposals here in New Zealand on, I think it was a 10 billion green technology investment that was looking at saving about a million tons of CO2 per year. And remember, put it in the context of 14 million tons in Kuala Lumpur of transport emissions. And I worked out the cost per ton of reduction. It turned out to be somewhere in the region of $9,000 or so. Now, with shared micromobility, or even private micromobility, which we'll talk about later, shared micromobility certainly doesn't require that upfront capital investment because it's run commercially and with experienced operators, and therefore it makes a lot of sense.
We're speaking today with Faris Faisal, a transport consultant from ARUP, as well as Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micromobility Research Partnership, about public transportation in Malaysia, specifically the first and last mile issue, and where micromobility comes into the picture here. So scooters, bikes, things like that. We'd like to hear from you. Basically, do you think micromobility is the answer? And also, do you have suggestions on how we can solve this first and last mile problem? Do you have questions that you want to ask? Maybe you can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp, or send us a voice note 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:51. You're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. Today we're talking about public transportation and how to solve the issue of the first and last mile, where micromobility, so e-scooters, e-bikes, where that enters the picture. So we've been speaking today with Faris Faisal as well as Ferdinand Balfort, and we are asking you for your thoughts and questions, basically. If you want to offer suggestions, if you want to ask questions, you can call 7733-2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio. So just to say that we've been talking about this, and this has come up a number of times in the messages as well, that in April this year, the Transport Minister, Dr. Wee Kah Siong, did announce a ban of certain micromobility vehicles on public roads. What has the impact of that been? Fernand, would you like to take that?
Yes, my understanding is that the vehicles, the micromobility vehicles, e-scooters, were banned from the roads, but that the local councils could make their own decisions as in regards to whether they would like to deploy, but that there was a lack of infrastructure framing around how to do that. And that's my understanding, that after that, the e-scooter usage has dropped off, and that generally we are waiting for some guidance to come through.
So on that note then, we have this message from a listener, Loa, who says, the minister has outlawed the use of micromobility vehicles on public roads. By right, he should have drafted a set of instructions on where and how they can be used, like limiting the maximum speed. So just to extend that point, what would we like to see here? What has the engagement with the ministries been like on this? And what has the response been? What's the ideal, basically?
Well, I can talk from the perspective of the MRP and just looking at how things are set up around the world. And we do get engagement with government agencies and with research bodies and so on. I'm currently working on aspects in other Asian countries and also here in New Zealand. There's definitely a role for experienced and well-established operators to be involved, because they can be held accountable under service level agreements with KPIs, and they are also made responsible for certain things like providing the right level of safety and the technology features to ensure that the e-scooters don't just race off at high speeds and busy areas with pedestrians, for example, and where you can monitor how these vehicles are being used. And I think that's really critical, that the right standard and the right quality of vehicles are deployed under quality care. And that's also important because from the early stages, when the early operators start to introduce rather cheap and lightweight models overseas, in America, for example, you found that they are highly unsustainable. And there's a lot of academic reports about that which show that compared to a private vehicle, if you've got a scooter that only lasts for about 6 months and then falls apart and has to be thrown away, the emissions are about the same or even higher than a private vehicle. So it's important to keep that sort of thing in mind, that the operators themselves also have expertise from overseas to bring to the table and say, well, this is how you could potentially adjust or adapt the local environment to these vehicles in the optimal way.
Ferdinand, if I could follow up on that, because if we're going to be talking about usage and duration of lifetime, right, lifespan of these vehicles, we have this point from Munif, who says, while the government usually takes all the flack when it comes to an abysmal public transport network, micro-mobility vehicles, the worry falls squarely on the people. Do I need to elaborate? Old bikes chucked into drains, remember that? Already the climate, poor urban planning and an unreliable governing body is making the public transportation situation so difficult. Let's not add a garbage mentality into the mix as well. And I just wanted to ask you to respond to that, right? Like, how do we contend with this issue? Because it is true that we have seen micromobility vehicles treated or even disposed of in a certain way.
Yes, and I would have to say that we see that in the early stages of the introduction is that, as Farah said before, it takes often behavioral change takes quite a significant time, up to 10 years. Although I think it will be a bit faster because the way you do it, you might inculcate a change of behavior much faster in terms of responsibility for vehicles that you use, shared vehicles or the equipment on it. And I think that goes back to like behavioral change in all aspects of sustainable living, like not wasting things, not throwing things on the roadside, not littering, all those sort of issues come to the fore as well. So it's just a question of education and of monitoring. And over time, these things do improve. A second point I would make about that is we tend to just talk about e-scooters in a broad sense. You have a private e-scooters and you have shared e-scooters. Now, the issue is that there are a lot of private e-scooters around as well. I mean, Sedgway in China announced that the ratio is about 1 to 5. So they make one shared e-scooter for about 5 private e-scooters. So we don't always know when people say, I saw this e-scooter discarded. Who was it from? Was it the shared e-scooter or was it private e-scooter? Or if there's a misdemeanor like running a red light, it's very difficult to know whether that was a person on a shared e-scooter or private e-scooter. So it almost also raises a question about some regulation around private vehicles. And Farah's before made a question to me as well about etiquette, and you might want to go into that, Farah, about the question of road etiquette and the way we should approach that. Farah?
Thanks, Farah. So,
sorry.
no, don't worry about it. For behavioral change, especially in the sense of road etiquette, it can happen organically. So for example, recently over the years you've seen a lot of uptake on cycling as a sport rather than as a commuting function. And of course in the earlier days people do not know how to behave on both sides of the discussion. Cyclists do not know how to ride on the streets properly, as well as drivers do not know how to drive with the presence of a cyclist. And that has seemed to got better, especially in areas where there are a lot of cyclists, but that went through very harsh growing pains. There were a lot of fights between both parties. There were a lot of there were accidents, unfortunately. So in the case for micromobility, you don't want that to happen. So that's why if I could just touch on the whole aspect of safety and the introduction of the regulation to ban micromobility on roads.
Faris, sorry. If I could just cut in, because we are 30 seconds away from the 7 o'clock news, but we'll come back to that. So if you hold that thought, we'll return to the issue of safety. We're talking today about public transportation and the issue of the first and last mile, where micromobility comes in after this safety, I promise. So do keep those thoughts, messages, questions coming, and keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning, BFM 89.9.
It is 7:09 and this is Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila. We're continuing our conversation now, as promised, on public transportation and micro-mobility. So we are speaking today and have been for the last hour with Faris Faisal, transport consultant from Arup, as well as Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micro-Mobility Research Partnership. So before the news, Faris, I interrupted you. You were talking about the issue of safety, and that is a big concern really when it comes to micro-mobility vehicles. So what's your take on this? How would you respond to people saying that they're unsafe?
So it's okay, don't worry about it. It's leaving the listeners on a cliffhanger, the dark arts of media, right?
Dark arts.
I think initially you just have to acknowledge the fact that all the stakeholders are aligned to one singular goal, which is to ensure the safety of the end user itself. And then in terms of infrastructure, the end goal is thinking, okay, we have a dedicated cycling lane. Then that will give people the confidence to be able to not only use micromobility devices, but also cycle as well. Safely improving the pavement infrastructure to ensure there's no trip hazards. You have all the panels in place so they can walk easily. But at the same time, a very important aspect to address is also etiquette. So the interaction between different transport modes on a mixed traffic area, that's very important because like the example I gave just now was the growing pains for people to start accepting how to drive while having cyclists on the road. And this is the same with having micromobility on the road. Right now, most probably people will be on, riders will be on pavements and then at parks. So you'll be sharing the space with pedestrians. So from the operator side, they introduce things like geofencing where you're not able to go to these areas. And then you can also introduce an artificial speed cap to ensure that they're at a safe speed while operating in these areas. But it's also the education towards the users itself. So there's many platforms right now. You can have YouTube videos where they simplify on how you should behave while riding micromobility devices. There's the whole special licenses you have to take with JPJ if you want to use micromobility devices. And in those modules, you can introduce this as well. When you're opening the app to now pay for your micromobility trip, there can be reminders and you can have guides on there as well. And then that sort of behavioral change, which also comes from different aspects of social life, which is the whole littering, throwing your micromobility devices in anywhere you go. Those are things you need to instill within yourself. But more importantly, there has to be a policing effort within the community itself, because sometimes people don't know what they're doing is wrong. There are times where they do know, but they feel like children, they test limits of parents. They feel like, oh, this is okay, test a little bit more. So you need people to start, as a community, develop this better habit.
So speaking of behavioral change, there is an association, particularly in the city centre, of scooters being more of an option for tourists or for joyriders, which also ends up then with micromobility vehicles being associated more with fun rather than functionality. How would you respond to that?
When micromobility is first introduced, you've got the safety issues, and then you've got the joyriding aspect, because being on an e-scooter is real fun and psychologically very rewarding. But as the accessibility grows and as the number of vehicles that you can reach and rely on being available grows, then people start to switch more and more towards using it for commutes. I just wanted to go back on the safety question, because I know that this is a real burning question, and just quickly, a study in the United States found that 80% of accidents on e-scooters were caused by cars. And a lot of these car accidents were caused because the car drivers, as far as is said, don't know the etiquette of being on the road with other road users. And these are classified as vulnerable road users, VRUs, and that includes bicycles. But when we do actual studies, and with the MRP, we are doing some of these studies in different countries. In some countries, it can be that e-scooters have 10 times less serious injuries compared to bicycles. Bicycle accidents are a lot more severe, and there's a lot more fatalities. And e-scooters have been, because they're so novel, in the spotlight a lot. So every time when there is a fatality, God forbid, then that it's highlighted and everybody goes like, well, this is highly risky. But when you actually do the numbers and comparisons, you'll find that bicycles are far and away more dangerous. But again, because they're on the same road as cars, and because cars are so predominant in our transport mix.
We do have a voice note from an anonymous listener raising a number of interesting points.
Hi, BFM. All your consultants today are only looking at the problem from the point of view of commercial. Never have they talked about from the point of view of the commuters ourselves. It's like, basically, at the current moment, Malaysia being very high in terms of private vehicles, whether it's motorcycles or cars, yeah. So the problem that I see from our point of view is that we need public transport to be cheap and fast from point A to point B. You see, being in a motorbike, if I can get to point A to point B within 30 minutes, but if I have to go on the MRT or your this micro mobility, whatever, you know, the cost is much higher and I take longer, it will not be an incentive for me to switch off my motorcycle to whatever you have in mind now. Same goes to car. Car now, petrol being subsidized, you know. So it's cheaper for me to think about driving, although the problem now with driving is the traffic jam. But I still think that it's cheaper, you know. So ask them to solve these two problems before they even talking about having what micro mobility la, this la, that la. Yep. Okay, I'm Cheong.
Cheong, thank you so much for that message. I mean, we also have someone else. We had an earlier message that came from Yong, who said, what is the cost and effort recovery to take public transportation vis-a-vis private cars? Does public transportation really save cost and time? And I think, you know, in some ways, what Cheong and what Yong are asking is exactly that, right? If it's cheaper for me and still more convenient to take my car, then what is the motivation here?
So that's actually a very valid concern. As I mentioned before, the whole infrastructure for public transportation within Klang Valley is not at its end game yet. So the issue people tend to face when they talk about higher expenses is because the travel journeys are further. When, like I mentioned earlier on, if you had to only make a 4-kilometer trip from a neighborhood to another neighborhood, you don't need to go into the city center and come out. But this circular function of a public transport network is not there yet. It's supposed to be there in the form of an MRT 3 line. But that's where buses or even micromobility devices or even bicycles can play a part. So micromobility is not just for your first mile, last mile journey. It's also to replace that shorter trips that you would have done so via a private vehicle. So that's the hope for it. Then later, when there's a higher demand for public transportation, as well as your more sustainable first mile, last mile journeys, that's when you start identifying if you're able to introduce other financial measures to help subsidize this form. So when I speak about this, I'm talking about excess charging or reduction of subsidy on petrol, or you can even have a thing such as figuring out if the tariffs on the import tax can be directed into this infrastructure projects. So those are the financial engineerings that will have to happen on the back end. But what we want to do is, you want to promote this as a whole. Like I said before, it's ideally things happen. So your infrastructure comes into play, then you start promoting public transport and micromobility, and then suddenly you have a rise in user uptake, and then this deters people from private vehicles. But rarely is that ever the case. Things need to happen in parallel. So providing these different options for the people who feel that, because it's, at the end of the day, it's a free market. So for people who feel that it's a price point that's reasonable, and it suits their daily commute, they might opt to do this. So then you have already a subsection of the daily commuters that will convert. Then that will then reduce the amount of traffic on the road for people who stay there. And this continues on throughout the whole cycle when you introduce things like a bus rapid transit system or a dedicated bike lane, that psychological effect of being stuck in a jam and seeing people zoom by you in more efficient transport mode, then that's where we ask, are we able to value, are we able to monitor, quantify that value and say, okay, this is the cost. It's not just about petrol prices. It's also about the frustration of seeing other people on more efficient modes. There's also the aspect of having fun when you're on a bicycle and you're on a micromobility device with the wind in your hair. You get transported back to when you were a kid riding your bike in your neighborhood. So that's one aspect as well of taking into account when you consider costs. And then also the things such as independence. So we're not just talking about commuters going to work. There are a lot of children that rely on these sort of modes because they do not own a car. So are we going to say they cannot have their independence because you have to rely on a private vehicle? And that sort of independent behavior will trickle into other aspects of their life as they grow up and create a different generation that has different ways of thinking. That sort of thing goes into cost counting as well, and it's things that you have to consider when you talk about all this personal cost to riding public transport and micromobility devices.
The other thing I would add to that is what Farah says, is that you'll have some of the early adopters who will see the total value of a ride versus the cost. And then as there is more uptake and as the market matures and so on, and there are more vehicles and more accessibility, then obviously price dynamics will change. And we see that in any transport mode for the moment, although I understand in Malaysia, fuels is subsidized. In Indonesia, they're talking about raising the level of subsidization, which is causing a lot of grief. And in a lot of countries around the world now, it's almost evident that electrical vehicles like private vehicles in Europe might not be sustainable or might not be taken up because of the cost of electricity due to the war in the Ukraine. So, you know, you never quite know where you're going to be. But in the long run, as these markets mature and these transport modes become more prevalent, then you'll see more and more equivalence and in pricing points. That's not even talking about, you know, an initiative like the German government, which is basically subsidized public transport, which is another thing that might be useful for a sustainable future.
We're speaking today with Ferdinand Balfort as well as Faris Faisal, both of whom are weighing in on public transportation and micromobility. We'll continue that conversation after this. Keep those thoughts coming. That number to call is 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp or send us a voice note 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bruce Freddie Morrissey, BFM 89.9.
It is coming up to 7:24. You're listening to Inside Story with Lynn and Sharmila, and we're closing off our discussion now on public transportation, particularly the first and last mile issue and micromobility. And we've been speaking for the last hour and a bit with Faris Faisal, a transport consultant from ARUP, as well as Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micromobility Research Partnership. So we have 6 minutes left. Going to try and speed through as much as we can. Right before we left off, we were talking about how the issue of cost is one that comes in and incentivizing people to take public transport. But there's also this other side of it that's coming through from Mukris, who's saying, who's talking about decentivizing private ownership. So Mukris says, I agree that major investments on infrastructure and micromobility are needed, but what about looking at the disposal vehicles policy or an initiative like cars over 15 plus years shouldn't be on the road? Maybe we need to entice the population into giving up their old cars and not having 6+ car per house. How would you respond to that? Is that a good idea?
So there has to be a push and pull measure. So you need to attract people to more sustainable transport modes such as public transport and first mile, last mile in active mobility as well as micromobility devices. But at the same time, it's Newton's first law, right? People already in motion, they just can't change. So in that case, you need to deter people away from private vehicles. So in order to do that, there's a lot of different measures. You could do it by direct policy changes, such as removal of cars over 15 years, deregistering cars over 15 years. You can reduce fuel subsidy. You can reduce the amount of available car parks within the city. So those are that. But as I mentioned before, there's also psychological techniques to it as well, where you introduce good public transport services. And if people can visibly see that while they're stuck in a traffic jam, they might be enticed to convert as well. You can introduce a better transport experience for the younger generation in hopes that they grow up to be a generation that believes that public transport as well as better active mobility and micromobility experience is a feasible way to commute in your daily working life. But it's important, however, I would just like to touch, it's important to not to be detached from reality. So cost is actually a very valid issue for a lot of families in Malaysia. So that's why motorcycles are actually very apparent on our streets. It's because of that aspect alone. So this is where you want a certain part of the community to convert when they can. And then now you reduce the amount of traffic on the road. And sometimes you have to view at the issue as getting from A to B doesn't necessarily just have to be a solution to solve that journey. It could also be making A to B closer. So that's where the whole philosophy behind 15-minute cities, all you need in your daily life is 15-minute walk from your home. You can also introduce policies such as working from home. So then you reduce the peak hours, the amount of cars on the road during peak hours. So these are other measures that you could introduce without addressing the whole cost issue behind converting to public transport.
We have just about 2 minutes left. Ferdinand, what would you like to leave us with?
Yes, it's a perfect ending, I think. It's what Faris has said, you know, behavioral change takes time. There are different levers that we have. And one of the levers that we are looking at very much is the modeling of sustainability. So if you look at 1 kilometer travel by an e-scooter, for people that are more attuned or more motivated by sustainability issues and emissions, which is especially our younger generation that Faris was talking about, they are concerned about the future. And that is just the way the demographics run, of course, because it is their future. And micromobility is definitely multiple times less emitting than a car or a bike. So as people get more and more sustainability conscious, they will start to think more and more about consciously how can they help to reduce emissions, because it is not going to be sustainable. And it was funny because the interlude, there were a lot of news reports and advertisements about sustainability, sustainable conferences, ESG, farming, you know, all this sort of stuff. It's obviously coming to the fore. Yeah.
Faris, Ferdinand, thank you both so much for speaking with us today. You've been listening to Faris Faisal, a transport consultant from ARUP, which is a global sustainable development consultancy, as well as Ferdinand Balfort, managing partner at Micromobility Research Partnership. And together we've been attempting to address the behemoth that is the Malaysian public transportation system, particularly the issue of the first and last mile, as well as where micromobility comes into play. So, keep those thoughts coming. We will continue to filter them and look through them and maybe pass them on as well. You've been listening to Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.